Once upon a time, in the not-too-distant past, if you heard the word socialist in a presidential debate, it was name-calling. But things seem to have changed, at least for this year's primary season, because the Democratic candidate with the current lead in delegates is Bernie Sanders, who doesn't treat socialism as a dirty word at all. He embraces the label, and he has for years. So while questions about the electability of a socialist candidate swirl around, we want to step back, take a deep breath, and just get a better understanding of what socialism even is, because it's been so taboo for so long that a lot of people probably don't really know. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're kicking off today's show with What is Socialism? We have two guests and I think two answers. Max Skidmore with us from the Political Science Department at UMKC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Without elaborating, what is your definition of socialism in, let's say, three sentences or less?
Well, the technical definition would be government or public ownership of the means of production and distribution.
Okay. Pretty concise there, Max. Mm-hmm. Deborah Leiter, also with us from the Poli-Sci Department at UMKC. Hello to you, too.
Hello.
Do you have a different working definition of socialism?
Actually, mine's really quite similar. It's a political and economic system where the state controls the means of economic production.
Economic production. Can you define that one?
Sure. So generally, the idea is that economies function through the control of different types of capital, different things, the ability to manufacture, labor, etc. In a socialist system, the state is the one who controls and regulates both the labor and those manufacturing rights and goods. In our current system, usually or often, those are held in private hands. So private companies both have the ability to manufacture and offer wages to people to for their labor.
Max, anything you want to add there?
No, that's comprehensive.
You know, it's interesting because I don't think this is a dramatically different definition, but the one that I first learned and the one that I keep in mind usually, I learned in high school, and it was socialism is a belief in the redistribution of wealth. Is that the same or different from what you've been saying? Because means of production is different from redistribution of wealth.
Well, that's an interesting formulation, and we actually have seen wealth being deliberately redistributed ever since Ronald Reagan, but it's distributed upward, not downward. So that couldn't be, per se, a technical definition. Socialism does involve redistribution, greater distribution of wealth, and a narrowing, if not elimination of, and that's never been an issue in America, but the narrowing of income inequality.
Why do you think that different people in, especially America, have different ideas about what socialism even is?
Well, some of that comes from our history. If we think back to the Cold War, which for some people feels like yesterday, and for some people now feels like ancient history, our political rival, our enemies, were self-identified socialists, right? The Soviet Union was a socialist state. They were the bad guys. They were our rivals. They were pushing for influence. So part of our history comes from that very political line drawing that was socialism versus capitalism, but we didn't call it socialism versus capitalism. We often called it socialism versus democracy. And that's a bit of a false dichotomy.
So, Max, maybe we also need to sort of clarify socialism versus capitalism.
Well, we also need to distinguish between socialism and communism, which is sort of socialism on steroids. Communism is based upon Marxism-Leninism, and it involves class conflict as a key criterion.
Democratic socialism.
Yes. Democratic socialism is based more on democratic cooperation as opposed to class conflict.
Can you flesh out that difference a little bit more?
Yes. It involves social welfare and measures of benefit to the people, but it involves democratizing economics as well as politics, in a sense.
So, Max, we were just hearing from Deborah about the history of feelings about socialism in the U.S. dating back to the Cold War and the McCarthy era. And I'd like you to maybe back up even further about than that to talk about socialism in America and how it's been viewed in American politics and culture over the years.
Yes. There was a brief flurry of enthusiasm on, at least on the left, for socialism in the United States in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And there have been socialist members of Congress, sometimes not seated, but New York Assemblyman and the mayor of Milwaukee has been a socialist. It has evolved through the years in which Americans tend to confuse social welfare programs with socialism.
Explain that.
Any government program that benefits the people, conservatives are likely to call socialism. And when you look at the effect of the word socialism in American politics, I believe it's considerably less now because of partly because of Bernie Sanders, partly because of new generations that look more closely at the shibboleths they inherited from their parents and grandparents. Does it matter that Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist? Well, he's not really a socialist. In Europe, he'd be a moderate social democrat.
How would you define that?
One who's in favor of social welfare programs.
So,
and you can have those in a socialist system. You certainly can have them in a capitalist system. And theoretically, you could have a full-fledged socialist system with no social welfare at all.
Give an example of a socialist democratic program in a capitalist society.
Social Security.
Okay, talk. Talk about it.
Medicare.
Explain how those things are what you're saying they are, which is social democratic programs in a capitalist society.
Yeah, Social Security is a government program, but it's run very much like a private program. It's just that the government happens to be the entrepreneur. People pay premiums, and I'm using air quotes, which you can't see on the radio.
I can see them, Max.
People pay premiums in the form of taxes, FICA taxes, and their benefits then are calculated according to their average earnings throughout the 35 years of their most affluent working years.
So then when we talk about the Cold War and the McCarthy era and that how that affected mm-hmm. people's understanding, I think we have to talk a little bit more about communism as opposed to socialism, communism being a form of socialism, but an extreme form of
yes.
socialism. Can you explain, the concern I think people associate with socialism because of that confusion of communism versus socialism has to do with a repressive state.
That's correct. And the tendency on the right is to assume that socialism equals repression. And it has done so with regard to Marxist-Leninist regimes. Certainly, the Soviet Union was a police state. China is still a police state, not a totalitarian state, but a police state. Cuba, a police state. But democratic socialist countries are not, there's no correlation between democratic socialism and repression at all.
Give some examples of democratic socialist states.
Great Britain during part of its post-war existence. Most of Western Europe, to some extent, is a social democratic area.
Well, so I want to turn to Deborah Leiter. Deborah, Max has a lot of expertise in American political history. I'd like you to talk to us a little bit about how socialism has evolved and been perceived in the rest of the world, starting with Europe.
Yeah, in the rest of the world, in the United States, we've frequently used socialism as a dirty word, but in much of the rest of the world, socialism is used in the same way that you might use democratic, republican, conservative, or liberal. It's a political position. In fact, for example, in France, until recently, the largest or second largest party was the Socialist Party. Most European countries have either a socialist party, a social democratic party, a labor party, or in some countries, all three. Socialism and social democracy, particularly, have been major influences on European politics. You asked for an example earlier about democracy that used some type of social democracy or socialist system. And of course, we can turn to the UK today and look at their national health care.
So when you talk about a socialist system, I want to go back to your definition about the means of production. Mm-hmm. How can you explain what is going on in the UK today with their healthcare system sort of through that lens so that we really understand it?
Sure. And this is where things get a little confusing, because we could absolutely call the UK's approach to healthcare socialism if we view healthcare as an industry. And so by that, the state is the main provider of healthcare. To a certain extent, they'll allow private healthcare, but the vast majority of people in the UK get their medical services, and really all of them, through the state. If you're a doctor, you're employed by
the state,
the government of Great Britain. But the reason we might also call it social democracy is, what if we don't think about healthcare as an industry at all? What if we think of it as a service? Right? In the same way that we might think about
paving streets.
Yeah, absolutely. Paving the streets, public transportation. So in that case, people in the UK may call their healthcare socialist, but most of them call it nationalized healthcare.
And so when we talk about in the United States, I mean, this does tap into fears around universal healthcare provided by the government, that people, you know, the argument that you hear is that people don't want government officials as doctors.
Right. And that's an interesting point, and I've certainly heard it. But the other way to think of it is, really, doctors are doctors. It's who are they being paid by? Are they being paid through insurance companies? Are they being paid? Are their check come from the state? Does it come from you directly? That's, for me, the bigger question. And while I think there's always valid questions about whether or not the state is the most efficient producer of different outcomes, rather than saying it's the state or the doctor, it's the state or an insurance corporation, or the state versus your ability to pay the doctor.
When you think about socialism in the world outside the United States, now getting also beyond Europe, what are some of the sort of tropes that you would hear if you were, say, in Latin America?
Sure. And so socialism is a whole different idea in South America. And there's, in fact, a lot of people who associate socialism with Simón Bolívar, one of the sort of major founders of a lot of South American independence. In fact, although it's not the best example of a stable democracy, Venezuela calls itself a Bolivarian republic and has justified some of their state-centric approach to economics from that lens. So while it has a very tense history, some of that has to do with the relationship with the United States and the conflict over socialism throughout the Cold War.
Max, when you have been, so just, I want to bring this back a little bit to the current political climate in the U.S. When you hear the word socialist being thrown around in today's debates and commentary on those debates among pundits, whatever, do you have thoughts just sort of connecting the way the term is being used to your understanding of what the term actually means?
Oh, yes. And the best example of that is probably Medicare for All. Now, Medicare is an enormously successful program, and it's extremely efficient. And with regard to healthcare, government programs tend to be far more efficient than private programs. Medicaid, Medicare, the British National Health Service, the French healthcare system, all of them provide far more healthcare per dollar spent than any private system. And the same is true with Medicare here. Now, it's interesting as a point of political propaganda or public argument that Medicare for All has been shoved into the radical pigeonhole by, and sometimes liberals have accepted that as well as conservatives in this country. And they say, oh, we don't want government running healthcare. But of course, government doesn't run healthcare and Medicare. All it does is pay the bills. And they say, well, people love their private insurance. Pete Buttigieg recently has talked about Bernie Sanders ripping the healthcare from 160 million Americans who love their private plans. Well, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find 160, let alone 160 million Americans who love their private plans. They don't. Medicare beneficiaries tend to love Medicare. You don't love your HMO. Why not? Doesn't Medicare take away your choice? No, Medicare expands your choice. You're not limited to a network that private insurance companies do limit you to. And so there's a great deal of hype there.
When it comes to the labels as they apply to candidates, what are your thoughts about that? The label of socialist in particular.
Well,
and generally the candidate we're talking about is Bernie Sanders.
Right. I would say we don't have a socialist running in the United States. Bernie Sanders is not a socialist.
Why not?
He's a social democrat. He doesn't believe in mass government bureaucracies and the kind of policies that you associate with real socialists. And as I said, in Europe, he would be a moderate social democrat rather than a socialist. But it almost doesn't make any difference in American political discourse, because it doesn't make any difference who's running. The Democrat is going to be labeled socialist by the Republicans, no matter, even Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, both of whom were moderates.
And that's the sort of, when I said that, like, the history on this, in right. my lifetime anyway, has been socialist use as name-calling
exactly.
in debates, it is interesting to see that shift, because in some cases I'm hearing Bernie Sanders described that way for the purposes of name-calling, but it not across the board.
That's true. And he self-consciously identifies as a socialist. He likes to set himself apart. Politically, that may not be the wisest strategy. His policies don't differ that markedly from Elizabeth Warren's policies. They're very, very compatible. And yet Elizabeth Warren stresses that she's a capitalist, which is true.
So, Deborah, when you hear the term socialist as it's being used currently in our politics, what sort of bells go off for you as someone who has studied socialism in political contexts throughout the world?
For me, it's a reminder that when you have a two-party system, the ideological spectrum, which is this idea that when we're talking about politics, we can sort of arrange things on a line from farthest left to farthest right. And whenever I hear socialism being thrown around in American politics to address mainstream candidates, I am reminded of how narrow our ideological mm-hmm. spectrum is here. I think Max is exactly right that Bernie Sanders' positions would probably put him on the left end of social democracy. He's certainly asking for economic redistribution, but it's not so different than what most Europeans currently face. So that's what always I'm reminded of, is how, as much as Americans point to our level of polarization and how far apart the parties are, we're calling someone who's a little bit to the left of the mainstream Democrat a socialist.
When we work with the definition of socialism that government owns the means of production, is there sort of, getting beyond that very broad definition, are there details about what socialism is or is not that you think the American public in general doesn't have and maybe should?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things that you should be aware of when people are saying that they are socialist or when a party identifies as socialist. And one thing Max pointed out that is important is most socialists competing in modern democracies are no longer calling for a major revolution, right? That used to be the case.
There's major this revolution as in workers of the world, you have nothing to lose but your chains kind
exactly.
of stuff.
To completely change the capitalist system, which would include changing our globalized economy.
So, and that's generally not what people mean, you're saying?
Usually not. There are, of course, still some traditional socialists and communists in Europe today. You'll see them around, but they are not the vast majority. Most are saying today that there is a problem of economic redistribution and that the only way to resolve this is for the state to take a much more active role in the economy, including controlling and restraining how major industries act. But it's also important to keep in mind that even a lot of parties that identify as socialists aren't even calling for that anymore. They're really calling for pushing that economic share around through social programs.
Any last thoughts, Max, as we go?
Yes, that's quite correct. And classic socialists would have abolished private property. Democratic socialists accept the institution of private property and profit.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Max Skidmore, Deborah Leiter, both with us from UMKC's Poli-Sci department. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And you can keep talking to us about socialism on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Up next, who's visiting Kansas City? Are we a tourism hub yet? And do we want to be? I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. It's been a big couple of years for Kansas City in the pop culture spotlight. First, there was Queer Eye. The Netflix series filmed two seasons here in town, and the views of the Kansas City skyline that flashed across people's TV screens were almost as breathtaking as the stories being told.
Let's do this.
Don't give it up.
Hey, we're here, guys.
Ask for help. You're not invincible.
Sometimes you just need a little support.
And then, what could be a more compelling follow-up than a big Super Bowl win for this Midwestern city?
Touchdown, Kansas City!
If you were living somewhere else and you'd never really known that Kansas City was cool, I'd say 2019 was the year you found out and maybe put it on your list of possible vacation spots. So now we're looking at the state of tourism in our city at this pivotal moment. We're also asking how the tourists' experience here relates to real life for real Kansas Cityans. My first guest is Jason Fulvey. He's the president and CEO of Visit KC. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. So talk to me about these two big moments in the spotlight for Kansas City. I'm guessing they were pretty helpful to someone in your position.
Yeah, you know, that's stuff that happens in a community that you cannot afford to purchase, right? Those are things that put us in the spotlight that you can't plan for, but you absolutely have to try to capitalize on that energy that they both produce.
So when you... as someone who is running Visit KC, see Kansas City on the TV screen during Super Bowl coverage, for example, what is it that you see?
Yeah, so I'll ask you a question first.
Okay. You should know I'm not a major football watcher, but...
I'm assuming you watched the big game, right?
I did, yes.
Okay. Do you recall at any point the national media flipping to a shot in San Francisco showing a group of fans cheering on the 49ers?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember it because it didn't happen.
Okay, that's a good, that's a relief to hear.
But what you did see is that shot of Power and Light.
Totally.
With all the Chiefs fans. So that was so exciting to me. That was the stuff that I was looking for.
Why, I mean, they didn't know going into it that Kansas City was going to win. Why that disparity?
Yeah, well, I can't say why the national coverage didn't shoot to San Francisco. What I can assume is that we're better fans than their fans, right? And the energy that is coming out of this destination right now is so exciting. And that's the stuff that's really going to propel us into the future.
We'll get back to the Super Bowl and
sure.
Queer Eye, but your annual report for 2019 just came out, and I'm wondering if there are key findings, key takeaways that you want to share about the state of tourism in our city right now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, as we look at our successes of 2019, and that's kind of what our annual report does. It takes a look backwards, and you know, I'll put a finer point on a couple of things that I'll talk about. So I'm going to talk about things that we measure called room nights. And for those people that don't know what room nights are, Gina, if you stay in a hotel, you go on a weekend trip and you stay in a hotel for three nights, that's three room nights. So
gotcha.
It's the amount of time that you spend in that hotel room, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as we look at just conventions alone, and the numbers that I'm about to tell you are just the convention room nights that Visit KC touches. So there's other room nights that happen in the community as a result of Chiefs games, the individual hotels booking things, but just what
visiting
we booked.
Visiting cousins.
Yeah, yeah. Just what we booked alone in 2019. We booked 413 meetings in 2019 for 2019 and future years. Because remember, we're booking things already out to 2027, right?
It's pretty far.
So we booked 413 meetings. And those meetings are going to generate $325 million in future economic impact for the region.
Where do room nights come into this?
Yeah, so the room nights were more, they totaled more than 452,000 room nights. So that all adds up. So those 413 meetings generated 452,000 room nights. with a $325 million economic impact.
How does that compare to other recent years?
Yeah, so 2018, we booked only 295, only. We booked 295 meetings compared to 413.
That seems like a significant leap.
Yeah, it was a great leap. And all of the stuff that's happening in this community, a lot of the stuff that happened before I got here, you know, I've only been here a year and a half. But if you look at all of the investment, that $9 billion of investment, Power and Light District, the Lowe's Hotel, all of the new restaurants, the renovations of the current hotels, Streetcar, Kauffman Center, all of these things, right? The new airport added into that coming. Those are the things that are helping us get that word out. Because our package has improved, our destination has improved, but the problem is not a whole lot of people knew about it, right? So we don't have an asset problem, we have a perceptual problem. And that ties right back to what we opened this conversation on. When you have things like the Super Bowl and Queer Eye, that helps us get over that perceptual hurdle.
Can I talk about a couple of things I've noticed as a resident?
Sure.
Okay, one thing I want to run by you is the hotel scene seems really different to me than it used to be. And I'm saying that not as someone who stays in hotels because mm-hmm. I live here, but it just seems like, you know, you've got a lot of new restaurants and bars at hotels that are getting real cachet, mm-hmm. like places to be. And there seem to be more boutique-y places with energy and buzz around them. It used to appear to me to be more of a functional landscape hotel-wise. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment.
Why and how does something like that change?
Well, I think that at one point, this destination was really underserved with hotel product. And there were decisions made by the community and leaders of this community to make strategic decisions on improving the assets, improving the product. And as you continue to do that, you start getting a little different vibe, a different feel to the destination. And tourism and travel has changed over the last few years and what people are looking for. A lot of travelers now, the millennials and a younger generation, are looking for of that hipper vibe, that cooler feel. And then so the market responded to that, right? That's why you're seeing restaurants that are much cooler than they were. They were before, they were just utilitarian, right? That's where you took the family, you went and had a meal. Now it's all about experiences. And a lot of those hotels and restaurants are providing those unique experiences.
I want to talk about restaurants because this isn't just about the hotel restaurants. I went to a longtime Kansas City restaurant right on the edge of the crossroads on a Friday at happy hour time. It was late last summer, and just about everyone there, you could tell by just what you were overhearing, they were all there for the same event. Mm-hmm. It had something to do with gymnastics. I don't really remember the details.
Probably USA Gymnastics, yeah.
That sounds like a big thing that
would
have brought a lot of people to a restaurant. Our server, the first question we were asked when we were approached is whether we were from in town or out of town. And that has never been something I've been asked at a Kansas City restaurant before upon sitting down. Talk to me about that. What does that shift indicate to you?
Yeah, that tells me that that we're getting more people coming from out of town that are filling our hotels and our restaurants, right? And that's my goal, right? It's not just the conventions. It's trying to get those people that are coming in for getaway weekends and parties and events and concerts and things like that. So we're also, you know, I led this conversation by talking about meetings, conventions, but we're also promoting this destination to leisure travelers, right? And a new term.
How do you do that? Because I know that I'm sure that I am marketed to as a traveler mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, but it feels to me
little cookies on the websites, right?
Right, but it feels to me like I'm making choices about where I'm going based on very personal things and not based on an ad. I don't think I've ever seen an ad for a destination and been like, totally, I'm going there.
Yeah. Well, so because we have a finite budget, we're very laser focused on where we spend our marketing dollars on. And we do a lot of research. We're very data driven. We collect a lot of data points. So we know who's buying us. We know the demographics of those individuals. And
quote, buying us?
Yeah. So no surprise, the big decision maker is the lady of the household. Right. So we do a lot of catering to those families. to an older generation, because we do have a lot of assets for a more mature audience. We call them modern matures. I fall into a couple of those categories now in my stage of my life. So yeah, we know who we're targeting, and we look at destinations from a tourism standpoint. We're looking at those destinations that are drivable. And as we continue to add airlift with a new airport, we'll then expand our reach. But yeah, we focus on those folks that are going to get in a car with their families or with their girlfriends or with a spouse or a significant other and come in for a long weekend.
Why should someone who lives in Kansas City care how tourism is faring? I'm not on vacation. Know what I mean?
Yeah. And to your point, you know, you said you don't stay in hotels. And actually, statistics show that less than 1% of the local population would stay in a hotel, except during Super Bowl parades. So what's interesting is the revenue generated into this community. You know, I threw out a big number for economic impact for those meetings. The revenue generated saves every household in Kansas City, $550 in taxes. So if we didn't have that revenue coming in, and keep in mind, plain and simple, Visit KC is a sales and marketing entity. We're the sales agent of this destination, right? So we're a revenue generator. And as we generate that revenue, we're putting tax dollars back into the big machine. And it's saving the locals money. The other thing that it does too, and this is very important, particularly for our corporate community out there. You know, as I get around and I talk to CEOs and I ask them the things that's keeping them up at night, the same thing keeps coming back. They're having trouble enticing new talent to relocate here, engineers and what have you. If you think about this, if we create a destination that people want to visit, it also creates a destination where people might want to relocate, raise a family, start a business. It all starts with a visitation.
Can there be a tension between those two things, though? Because, you know, I hear a lot of concern about things being done for tourists as opposed to for locals. That was part of the debate around streetcar, honestly. That's part of the kind of talking points you hear is who is it for? And the idea that it would be just for tourists is seen as this negative.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's just for tourists. You know, we just talked about you going out to those restaurants, right?
And I have ridden the streetcar.
Yeah, and I ride it all the time too. I think it's a benefit for everybody, but it creates a better sense of place, a better way of living. And as we continue to increase revenues and put more tax dollars back into the process, it helps with all of the social services that we all benefit from.
You are actually an out-of-towner yourself, or you were before taking this job. Yeah. How did you initially experience Kansas City as a visitor before you moved here? Because I have to assume you came once or twice to check it out.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the first time that I came to Kansas City, and that was about 16 years ago. And when I left, I said, yeah, check the box, right? Move on. And when they called me for this opportunity, my wife and I still joke about it. I told her, I'm going to go listen to these people, but there's no way we're moving to Kansas City. Just not happening. And then I got here. And I remember that defining moment when I was standing in the Power and Light and I was looking at all the stuff that was happening there and looking up at the convention center, cranes in the sky. And I called her and I said, I think you need to come back out with next weekend with me and take a closer look.
Cranes in the sky. Tell me why that was like, ooh, bring me
that's
to the place.
That's important,
the
right? Because that's
sky.
Showing development, right? That's showing progress. And whenever you... When you, and it's funny because whenever we bring people in to kind of kick the tires, potential meeting planners, that's one of the things that comes up all the time. Oh, there's construction going on. They get excited about that because that shows progress.
Interesting. So it doesn't show them a pain in the butt?
No, not for visitors. Yeah.
We have to take a break. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Visit KC's Jason Fulvey about the changing state of tourism in our city. In just a minute, we will also hear from an Iowa-based consultant for cities across the region looking to change and grow and thrive. Is tourism part of that equation? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. We will be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking to Jason Fulvey of Visit KC. Now let's hear from another guest. Zachary Mannheimer is a principal with Alchemy Community Transformations, a firm that consults with Midwestern towns and cities that are trying to attract more young people and creative people. Hi, Zach.
Hi there.
What are you hearing in this conversation so far, particularly when it comes to this link between tourism and attracting new residents who want to be part of the city in a more long-term kind of way?
Well, I think, Jason, I would agree with everything he was saying. Visit KC is doing all the work that should be done to grow the community, to grow the region. What's interesting is that for the past, I'd say, two decades, I forget the exact number that he quoted, but several billions of dollars have been invested into infrastructure and social spaces and just the general community in itself. And so that work is ongoing, obviously, but now that a lot of that is done, now we can really begin attracting that creative and entrepreneurial culture.
What is the first step in doing that once you've kind of established a tourism culture?
So we have to listen to the people who are on the ground, who are the artists who are in the Kansas City area, who are the entrepreneurs in the area. Let's hear what their needs are and let's work to address those. But at the same time, we have to be creating specific marketing pieces to reach the type of people we're looking for. And in the conversation you were having earlier, in terms of how am I being marketed to? Am I a traveler? And Jason was saying that, you know, they're looking for the mom of the household, and that's who they're marketing towards. And I hear that in almost every Midwestern community, that's they're all competing for the mom.
Can I just jump in and say, when we think about trying to attract residents, on the other hand, a phrase like the type of people we're looking for could set off alarms for some listeners, just because of the idea that there is a desirable resident, and then that implies also a not so desirable resident.
Sure. Well, I would say what I mean by the type of people we're looking for, people who want to contribute to the community in an artistic or entrepreneurial manner. That's what I'm saying. I don't think those are the only people that should be moving to a region, but that is a focus that many communities are putting.
Along the lines of the question I just asked, I think there are also fears about gentrification when you think about tourism.
Absolutely.
And Airbnb prices and sort of a demand on rent and things like that. Or like when you're pushing for these sort of like sexier things that are marketable, what happens with just sort of boring stuff like laundromats?
Laundromats are always going to be necessary. Gentrification is good and bad. Gentrification means that things are progressing, but it also is bad because it could push people out of their neighborhoods that they've been in for quite some time. So it's very tricky to do this in a smart manner. And that's why a good strategic plan is necessary for any community to grow. But we can target our certain neighborhoods that we want to preserve, whether that means we want to preserve the architecture historically, whether we want to preserve to make sure the people that are living there currently can continue to live there from a financial standpoint. There are ways to do that and still grow the area. And some of it has to be with the city expanding itself, just geographically. I mean, the Kansas City metro is a little over 2 million people. That wasn't true 10 years ago. So it's ever expanding. We're not going to be able to build, even though we try to build on top of each other. As technology keeps increasing and getting better, it's going to be easier every day to work further away from where you live. Some people want to do that. Some people don't. But creating that type of infrastructure and trying to attract the people that are looking for those types of amenities, that's how we can grow a region and hopefully not keep all of our neighborhoods from gentrifying to the point where they're unrecognizable 10, 20 years from now.
I want to take some calls. Sheila in Kansas City, good morning.
Hi there, Gina.
What do you want to ask?
Well, I guess what I would like to talk about is the disconnect between those doing so well and all of the wonderful things we're doing downtown and the skyrocketing rents in Kansas City and the fact that Jackson County has super high eviction rates on a daily basis. And I am blind as low vision specialist at the whole person, and I see people who, you know, lose their abodes and who are not very well equipped to pick themselves up by the bootstraps and compete.
And so you're wondering how this relates to tourism?
Well, I want to know how, let's say, the extra money that we're generating from tourism and also the strategic plans that have just been mentioned. And I was on the phone with the producer and didn't hear everything, but I just would like to see Kansas City really make sure that that some of this money really goes to the people who can't participate in the niceties that other people are, that we're trying to attract here to the city. We can't let the people who are already at the bottom get even further behind.
All right, Sheila,
we can see that in San Francisco and LA, and yeah.
I'm going to let our guests respond to this, and I'm going to start with you, Zach.
Sure. It's a really good point, and it's a concern that we hear everywhere. And so I would agree that some of the revenues that are being generated, can we create a fund specific to make sure that communities are being kept as they are, but still growing? But the other piece is that a lot of those folks that you're mentioning are not part of the conversation when it comes to developing a community and seeing the way that the city wants to grow. And that's really taking a grassroots approach. We like to say that whenever you go into a community, we create steering committees from the people that we want to hear from to get all the ideas. But it's not enough to just have the usual suspects at the table. We say that if Kansas City is a high school, we want the head of every clique. We want the popular kids. We want the sports kids. We want the drama kids. We want the nerds. We want the geeks. We want every possible angle. All the people that would make up Kansas City, we want the head of every demographic sitting at that table, sharing what's good and what's challenging about growing the community. That's the only way that we can do this in an equitable way.
You know, I have a question for you, Zach. In your observation of just a variety of cities throughout the Midwest, what is it? Do you see a connection between the person who experiences something positive as a tourist, someone who is one of these people who, as you say, we want at the table, every demographic, but someone visiting the city and seeing something cool being someone who then makes that leap to, I want to go there, I want to live there?
Yeah, we do see that. It's definitely in larger places that we're seeing that happen. And tourism does lead to population growth. And that can be positive or negative, depending on your perspective. And so in our opinion, the way to doing the conferences, doing festivals, certainly it doesn't hurt that you won the Super Bowl, having Queer Eye there. All of those pieces are really great pieces of the puzzle. Everybody in the country, and if not the world, has now heard of Kansas City and are curious. And so their attention has been gained in some manner. The question now is, what's the next step? How do you get them to the community first to visit? And once they're there, what are they experiencing? How can you show them, if you're coming for a specific event, how do you open their eyes up to all the other pieces that Kansas City has? Hey, I can talk from a personal standpoint.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we visit Kansas City frequently, and we started coming simply because we were coming to a specific attraction, whether it was the Science Center, whether in Union Station or the Lego Museum, and we were coming just for that. But by wandering around downtown and learning about the community, we began to find the other neighborhoods that were surrounding the area. But that took maybe 7 or 8 trips to experience that. Not everyone's going to do that. How do we get people understanding what Kansas City has to offer beyond the specific thing that's bringing them there?
Jason Fulvey, what's your answer to that? I mean, you must have an answer to that.
Well, I wanted to chime in on the conversation about how tourism can help the community. And I'll give you a good example. And this is something that is very near and dear to my heart, is how do we make that connection between those conventions that come into town and let them leave a long-lasting mark on this community long after they're gone, right?
Of a good kind.
Of a good kind, right. So here's an example. In 2023, we have the National Society of Black Engineers coming in with their annual conference. So this is about 8,000 to 10,000 attendees, all students. 5,000 of them are typically getting ready to graduate with an engineering degree, looking for jobs. Now, we happen to have a lot of engineering organizations here. So I've been able to connect the dots between this conference and our corporate community and our other community, because the other thing that NSBE does is they do STEM education and scholarships for local kids to help them get through into transition into college, right? So we're putting some of our money where our mouth is, and we're supporting scholarships for those kids in the summer bridge program. For local kids. And then there's also STEM education that's happening as a result of that. But then we're also trying to build that funnel for the local community, for the underserved neighborhoods, to get them engaged in math and science and so forth, and hopefully build a pipeline for those engineering firms here.
You know, Jason, I want you to address something that a couple of our callers have been worried about, and mm-hmm. that is the city's proposed budget cuts for funding for Visit KC. How will that affect these plans?
Yeah, so, you know, from our perspective, we'll continue to do what we do, right? Those are conversations that we're going to continue to have with the locals, the local government, and continue to impress upon them that we're a revenue generation force. And I believe that the current administration understands that. So that's just an ongoing situation that we have to continue to talk about. But right now, we will continue to move forward and do all the things that we do.
Let's talk to Paul in Independence. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to make a comment about the transformational nature that a sports championship can play in a city. Excuse me. I'm originally from Detroit, and I happened to be there when the Red Wings, the hockey team, won a championship for the first time in 43 years. And it was a remarkably transformational moment for the whole city, because they used that opportunity to brand themselves as a hockey town. And Detroit became known as the most authentic place to experience hockey. I mean, more authentic than Toronto. And I think Kansas City stands on the world stage right now. It's up to us to decide to dance on it. We have all this attention, and it's just some clever marketing can draw people's eyes here, and then we have plenty to hold them. But if we use the football to bring him here, I think that puts us in a really good place.
Well, Paul, hang on just a second, because, Zach, this is interesting to me, a comparison to another city, say, Detroit. The word, I have to admit, had not reached me that that Detroit was maybe a place I should think about moving. I'll be honest. That's not the reputation I generally hear.
Detroit is a very specific case that doesn't fall into any typical category. There's a lot of good and bad that have happened in Detroit, but the caller's point, I think, is very good. And capitalizing on what you have in front of you. You won the Super Bowl. Everybody knows about you. Everybody knows who Patrick Mahomes is. How do you translate that into getting more people to come to the community? What is the marketing plan? What are you known for? Kansas City, obviously, is known for barbecue. It's known for music. It's known for the being a larger Midwestern city.
You know,
now it's known.
I would just want to say, he said that, you know, Detroit being the most authentic place to watch hockey, I would say Kansas City mm-hmm. is probably the most authentic place to go have barbecue.
I think there's a lot of places in the country that would challenge you on that. However,
I'll take them.
Me too. It's not a bad problem. You get to go try all of it. But what is singular about Kansas City, and this is something that we work on quite a lot. The recipe is right now to grow the next big thing coming out of Kansas City. Is that going to be another athlete? Is it going to be a scientist? Is it going to be an artist, an entrepreneur? We don't know. But the recipe is all there. We need to continue to push, help people work together to arrive at who that singular voice is going to be that helps the community rise.
Well, Zachary Mannheimer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And Jason Fulvey of Visit KC, thank you.
Thank you.
Our time is up for this conversation, but you can find anything from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. Grab links, share them with your friends, and then you can talk to them about all this stuff too. We just talked about the changing tourism landscape in Kansas City, and earlier in the show was, what is socialism in light of Bernie Sanders' current status in the ongoing Democratic primaries? KCUR.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a food show. We're talking about Asian food in Kansas City, and we're kicking it off with a lesson in cooking Thai food from Pete Doolin. So be sure and tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so stick around. Thank you.